Now we're about to finally immerse ourselves in the nuts and bolts of the classical art form. Before we do that, I want to point to two sets of issues, general sets of issues, that we have to deal with. One has to do with two types of hierarchies that are present in Hegel's discussion. One is a hierarchy of degrees of the fulfillment of beauty. And as you know, Hegel suggests that the classical art form is really classic when it comes to bringing beauty to its artistic realization, and that there's something about it that allows it to come closest to the ideal of beauty than either of the two other art forms. Nonetheless, those other art forms do still somehow satisfy what it takes to be works of fine art. That is, they too are going to satisfy everything that has been detailed in the account of what could be considered artistic beauty in general, which occupies the entirety of the discussion before we come to the investigation of the particular art forms. So in some respect, Hegel points to there being a kind of ranking with respect to the fulfillment of beauty. And even though that does not prevent works of art from having beauty, no matter what art form they have, there is still this kind of ranking. Now, to some degree, that ranking is also associated with the view that the classical art form is something that gives artistic expression to a worldview that can be most adequately deciphered by works of art, as opposed to either religion or philosophy. It's two other primary avenues of achieving a self-understanding of truth. You know, Hegel will claim that the symbolic art form is fumbling around trying to give expression to the self-understanding, which it is in some respect condemned to grapple with. It doesn't really have full-fledged clarity. It's seeking to unveil what it is giving expression to, and is never able to do so in a fully adequate way. But nevertheless, given all of that, and given the very character of what is regarded to be a fundamental value, it has no other option than to do what it's doing. By contrast, the Romantic art form has a self-understanding that is such that it transcends what a sensuous configuration can convey. And it has to show that very transcendence in its artistic expression. And for that reason, it has other cultural avenues by which to unveil the truth in a manner that is fully adequate. Ultimately, Hegel, I think, will want to say philosophy will do the job. Now, in addition, there is this hierarchy of truth, which is already implicit in what I've just said. Namely, as far as Hegel is concerned, we have these three fundamental forms of self-understanding. They're all grappling with what is the truth of humanity. They all have differing fundamental views of what that amounts to. The self-understanding of Romantic art is most true. The symbolic art form is least true. The classical art form is sort of in the middle. But we here have a kind of hierarchy of the truth of the self-understandings in question, or the adequacy of those self-understandings with regard to what is the actual truth of humanity. And note that that ranking with regard to truth is different than the ranking with regard to the kind of ranking with regard to beauty of the three different art forms. And we want to explore to what extent these parallel rankings make sense, hold up, are compatible with one another. And in connection with that, I also want to take up a kind of thesis you often hear. Hegel himself may be guilty of springing on the world to some degree. It comes out in one of his lectures on world history. It's not anything he published himself, but nonetheless, who knows, he may have said it. And that is in terms of characterizing what might be considered two fundamental forms of civilization. There is one in which only one person is free, Oriental despotism. Then there is the kind of civilization exemplified by the ancient Greeks in which some are free, and then modern civilization in which everyone is free. Now, I think already it should be clear to you by looking at how the types of conduct that are being artistically expressed in the art forms that we've encountered, it should indicate that this way of talking about the different types of configurations of humanity and of the self-understanding of humanity don't really fit this idea that you can say that one is free, some are free, all are free, because you don't have the same freedoms at stake, but just restricted to one, then to several, then to all. You don't have freedom in the same way in all three. There's something very different going on. And if you think about the way in which conduct is configured, or the kind of conduct that is configured in the symbolic art form, it's not as if anyone is exhibiting what could be considered freedom. And of course, here we have personifications of divinities, natural powers, and so forth. But in no way do you have, let's say, the human spirit, even of a single individual, exhibiting any genuine independence. It's always, in some respect, caught up with matters that are external to the independent subjectivity of the agent. The agent is personifying divinity or natural powers that themselves do not have, let's say, the concrete self-determined character of full-fledged human agency. So on the one hand, you have natural specifications or natural configurations imposed upon the agents that are portrayed in various ways, where they are mixed up with what could be considered animal formations in one way or another, or they're personifying natural powers that are not identifiable with the spiritual powers of knowing and willing, or alternately they could be said to be personifications of a divine, what is considered to be an ultimate fundamental reality, which is regarded as having a kind of indeterminacy to which the agent is trying to unite, because everything determinate is finite, and only what is indeterminate escapes the limitations of finitude. Well, by the same token, when you look at the kind of agency that's on display in the classical form of art that we're going to be looking at, throughout there is this idea that we here have an understanding of humanity where what is of fundamental significance to humanity is fully realized in the immediate particular sensuous existence of the individual and of conduct, or shall we say, the external appearance of conduct as it appears. And it appears, of course, with a certain kind of particularity what is it that Hegel will recurringly point to as not being recognized to be of significance in the portrayals of conduct, and for that matter of divinity in the classical art form? What does he refer to? As being absent.
Isn't it in the heart?
Sort of the heart. Another way of putting it with and he speaks of conscience and what he identifies as morality in the specific sense of that domain of conduct where, as he will point out, the individual operates as someone who has to act on conscience, meaning the individual has to, by his or her own resources, figure out what is the good and what they have to do to realize it, as opposed to take their cues either from existing institutions of which they are a member and in which they have determinate roles to play, which lay down what they should be doing and what aims they should be collectively aiming at, or alternately by taking their cues from something else. And as you know, Hegel will point out that in the scheme of classical art, where pathos will be at hand, and remember, pathos is presented as being a basic part of action as it is susceptible to aesthetic configuration. Here, pathos operates in a specific way, which need not be the way it operates. It has to operate in every case. You could say there's even a pathos when we are reading the Mahabharata and we're looking at the characters going at each other in various ways. There is a kind of pathos, but it's a pathos that's going to be connected to, on the one hand, the personifications of the divinities and also such things as the kind of caste-determined dharma that one has to fulfill, etc. Here Hegel will say that the pathos in question that gets portrayed in classical art form as informed by the example of ancient Greece is a pathos that on the one hand is going to be tied to the existing institutions of, we could call it the natural ethical community of the city, or ultimately of the household, as specific existing spheres of community, where you exercise roles and are subject to, shall we, norms that are already existent in those communities. And those communities also have a kind of particular reality. And I want to get into that in a moment. But the pathos is connected to these kind of, shall we say, ethical roles and memberships and involvements, rather than being a pathos that might be determined from within the individual subject through their own resources. Ultimately, the pathos will also be something will be spoken of as being connected to the gods. Now, the gods will, in some respect, inform this, as Hegel will say you find often in Homer. Or ultimately, with the pathos where characters take their cue from natural phenomena that are regarded as giving expression to the mind and will of the gods. Such as what will that be shown in? Which, of course, we find exhibited in the Iliad and the Odyssey. And Hegel will discuss it here, and we'll get to that later. But what aspect that seems to figure very prominently in the artistic expressions of the kind of conduct found to be worthy of artistic portrayal? Well, characters will take their cues from oracles, from divinations, entrails, all sorts of things like that. In other words, they will not be acting on the basis of conscience. That's not to say that they don't have their own individual subjective impulses and the like, but those are not regarded to be of essential significance. you know, when Achilles goes sulking in his tent, he's not doing something that is going to be regarded as being the focal point of what makes him worthwhile. So what I'm getting at is that when you're talking here about the kind of agency that is present for the humanity that is understanding itself with a civilizational form that will seek self-understanding through artistic expression of a classical form, the freedom in question is still something very different from the kind of freedom that we will finally find underlying the Romantic art form. And I just want to remind you of the kind of contrast Hegel drew up when he was speaking about the kind of world and the kind of situations that were appropriate for artistic portrayal. I mean, he spoke about a heroic ages, right, as being readily susceptible. Because in a heroic age, you have an individual hero whose own individual acts are going to be of momentous significance, because they're going to be founding a state, or they're going to be doing something on which the whole community is going to depend. And so too, you find something like that going on when you find works of art taking as their general characters what kind of individuals who have what kind of role, that fuses what is of universal significance with the individual. Which we'll also find not just in works of classical art, but in Shakespeare. Well, you'll have kings and royalty, people of this sort, who, in their own individual person, have the fate of the nation in their hands, or have something bound up with them. That's of a much broader significance. By contrast, Hegel will speak about, well, the prosaic character of a fully developed modern civilization, where the institutions of freedom are in play, where everyone's freedom is an exercise of right that is common to all, where we're dealing with a type of conduct that is inherently universal, and where what individuates it from other people is not of any special significance, and where it doesn't matter if a president is assassinated to any great degree, because the successor is going to exercise the same kind of limited power, and things will more or less go on as they had before, to a greater degree, more or less. And here it's, we here have a freedom that could be said to be realized in its full-fledged universality, where there's no inherent conflict between the different spheres of justice, where the state is such that it allows people to exercise their social freedoms and their household freedoms without finding themselves in the kind of conflicts that Antigone and Creon are in. It's a different kind of freedom here. And it's going to be a kind of freedom that is not going to be essentially tied to any kind of particular sensuous configuration. Whereas in the world of the classical art form, where humanity, what is essential to humanity, is what is present in a sensuous configuration, or is can be captured in the sensuous configuration, in the immediate, shall we say, sensible existence of conduct and action, with all the particularity that accrues to it. That means we have a different kind of agency and conduct at work. So, for example, when you speak about the kind of dramatic conflict that Hegel points to, as if it had some, perhaps some kind of emblematic significance for the content of works of art in general, but it has something particular to do to the self-understanding of a world that will express itself artistically in a classical art form. Here you have these ethical communities that have a natural character. They have a given character. They're not they're not a family order or a political order that is completely in accord with reason and can be specified by reason and has a form that is completely universal and conceptually determinate. It has traditions that have a given character, a particular character. And for that very reason, the different ethical spheres are not in any pre-established harmony. They can and do collide. And it's their very particularity that is what is going to make them susceptible to those kind of collisions and allow for a certain kind of conflict that is not going to be present in terms of the fully worked out institutions of freedom. So I just want to say all of that in terms of be wary of this this recipe that either Hegel thinks or that we can adopt what he says or what he's reputed to have said and distinguish the kinds of civilizations that are here being fitted onto the different art forms as if we start with one in which one person's free and another some are free and in the third everyone's free. They're qualitatively different kinds of, shall we say, freedom or agency at hand. Yeah.
Would you say that fascism was an attempt to resuscitate a sort of classical understanding of freedom that's tied to a particular sense of liberation?
I mean, one way of discussing this, and I've done this, by the way, in various places, one is in a book called Modernity, Religion, and the War on Terror. I think one can speak about modernity not as simply a purely historical category referring to a particular time period, and that the modern is what happens in this time period. One can also look upon it as something that has a normative character. That is, one can regard the modern as being a certain kind of civilizational project, one in which it is recognized that the institutions that should count as valid should be based not on tradition, but determined by reason, and that reason determines that what has normative validity are institutions of freedom. So modernity can be regarded as that civilizational project which is attempting to realize the institutions of freedom. And one can regard it as something that may have descriptive utility for that particular biosphere in which there are rational agents who have come to a significant degree enact those kind of institutions. And as far as Hegel is concerned, he is witnessing in his time in a particular part of the world significant developments that can be understood to be fundamental parts of the enactment of the institutions of freedom. And these include such things as the French Revolution, the Protestant Reformation, and the Industrial Revolution, all of which are, in a sense, destroying the remnants of feudal society and presenting a new kind of civilization, which Hegel regards as both rational and legitimate. But I don't think that he's often spoken of as if he thought that there's some necessity to the emergence of such a civilization, and that we can regard the course of history as actually having an end from a descriptive point of view. So that it will necessarily lead to this. I think instead he recognizes, like I think any philosopher worthy of the name, that history is inherently contingent. We're talking about the domain of convention, where it's basically arbitrary. But nevertheless, if one can think what institutions should be, then one can also reflect on what has to happen for them to come into being. And one can do that philosophically and conceive, given the nature of the institution of freedom, what transformations have to occur when they do not exist to get to their emergence. And then what one can also do is engage in what Hegel seems to be doing in his lectures on the philosophy of history. Namely, he's reflecting on the historical record. That's not an act of philosophizing. That's an act of historical, empirical judgment. And he sees that, well, the institutions of political, social, and family freedom are beginning to come into existence in his time. So he can therefore say, well, we can look back on recorded history and reinterpret it as a history of the emergence of freedom. Because in a sense, that seems to be what's happening, based on the fact that we here find these institutions being fought over and beginning to propagate themselves around the world. That doesn't mean it has to happen, or that they won't be overturned. But I say all of this to get back to fascism, because you can look at two kinds of anti-modern movements. One are those anti-modern movements that want to basically make given traditions determinative of what counts. And that one can speak about those, broadly speaking, as being pre-modern, a pre-modern view of civilization. We regard civilization to have to rest on foundations. Because institutions of freedom have no foundations from a normative point of view. They have enabling conditions, but they are what they determine themselves to be, and that's what gives them their normativity, that they're institutions of freedom. On the other hand, you can have all sorts of traditional formations that are based upon all sorts of different given factors that are privileged, you know, the ways that our ancestors in one form or another define themselves. It could be a particular religious order, a particular vision of theocracy, or whatever. And so you can have an anti-modern revolt, which is inspired by an attempt to reassert such traditions, where civilization takes its guide from certain privileged foundations. Then you can also have fascism, which I think is something different. And of course, when I say this, I'm speaking about what might be considered to be the most powerful theoretical representatives of fascism, who I think follow in the footsteps of Nietzsche. And they basically regard what we might otherwise speak of as rationality, namely reason and autonomous conduct, as actually involving attempts to advance values that can never be rationally justified, but always issue from some particular foundation, but a foundation that is arbitrary and not susceptible of justification. So given that, what the fascist wants to do is to advance norms that emanate from something particular. And in advancing norms, you're shoving them down everyone's throat, because norms are universal in character. So you're shoving norms down everyone else's throat that emanate from something that you recognize to be particular and unjustified and ultimately arbitrary, but you're going to do it without making any excuses. So you're going to, in a way, absolutize something particular, like the Aryan identity, and make it achieve world domination. Not because it necessarily has any rational justification, but we're just going to be asserting that. And in a sense, we're doing what everyone does when they assert values, but we're doing it in a consistent way. Whereas the proponents of democracy, on Nietzsche's understanding, are basically advancing a slave morality. They're putting forward what they purport are universal norms, freedom, socialism, etc. But what they really do is advance a particular interest, the interest of the weak and degenerate, because the universal norms are going to benefit them by disempowering the high and mighty. And that unveiling is supposed to show that, you know, these universal norms, which allegedly are based on reason, are really not. They're based on something particular. They want to hide that. But if we recognize that all assertion of norms is really a will to power, or some group is advancing something that is particular to them, let's do it consistently and brazenly advance a will to power And one might look upon fascism as operating in that way, as advancing the particular over against the universal, and in that regard, advancing something that has nothing to do with freedom, and imposing an order that could be regarded as a kind of postmodern regime, in the sense that postmodernism, following in the footsteps of Nietzsche and Deleuze and these other proto-fascists, are all basically claiming that what we call rationality is a conditioned exercise of will to power, where it attempts to put forward norms, but norms can never be free of foundations. They always rest on some foundation. They always emanate on something that is their ground, but those grounds are arbitrary and insusceptible of justification.
And the conditions.
And then if you want to be consistent about it and not make any bones about it, then you just advance a particular as a particular, and that's who you are. Yeah. And I think that's what some of the more, let's say, sophisticated fascist ideologues under Nazism advanced. Not claiming there was any actual scientific racial superiority to Aryans or anything of that, but just putting forward this kind of project.
Yeah. Well, this conditioned exercise, yeah. The conditions have an illusion on them, right?
Not... Well, the illusion would be that they're masked, and one is purporting to put forward norms that are either based in nature in general or dictated by reason. So this is different from a reversion to the classical art form, in a way, precisely because it rests on this understanding, at least I'm giving it as something that's not just a matter of pre-modern, reversion to pre-modern traditional societies, but a kind of postmodernism that wants to do something that it recognizes to be arbitrary, not founded in nature, not founded in this unity that to some degree is there in the classical worldview. That, however, has found a nature that is a nature that is fully congruent with the human spirit. So nature in question is the actual given nature of the human being, which is regarded to be of universal significance. Yeah.
Would that claim to arbitrariness and the condition, reason just came as kind of conditioning response, rests on the assumption also that reason can't be self-determining?
Yeah, exactly. That all reasoning, I mean, and Nietzsche will say that, you know, how can reason, for example, be responsible and establish its own authority? Because it has to use itself to do so. Isn't it thereby begging the question? Isn't any critique of reason by reason fundamentally flawed and incoherent? Because how can it examine itself without taking for granted its own authority? Now Hegel attempts to show how reason can be self-determining. And that's not what Kant is doing. You know, it's not based upon engaging in a transcendental term, where you do make use of a reason to simply spell out the conditions of knowing, just as pre-critical philosophy took for granted its own reason in reading off the character of being. Something else has to be at work. And that's something Hegel addresses in both the Phenomenology and the Science of Logic. But, when you ask the question of, well, whether is fascism and maybe its artistic expressions a throwback to a classical art form under conditions where humanity is otherwise understanding itself in a way that is more appropriately given aesthetic expression in romantic art, one can raise this question with regard to, let's say, neoclassicism. Which you see maybe most prevalently in architecture, and an architecture that is all around us here on campus, that's all around us in the antebellum South, and not just the antebellum South, One might even say, well, do you have something like that going on in the Renaissance? I think it's worth thinking about whether the appropriation of forms that might be connected to those of classical art is equivalent to embracing the classical art form, or whether their use is somewhat different. And that's something that we can take up later, but it's a question to ask. Or is it something that is aesthetically flawed because it's a use of a certain kind of artistic configuration that just doesn't fit what can be taken seriously as the truth of humanity? Now again, one of the questions we want to grapple with is, you know, we have these three forms in which meaning and configuration can go together. You can sort of see how, from a kind of logical point of view, they exhaust the possibilities. You have a meaning that's of such a character that it's too impoverished, too abstract in certain respects, to be able to be captured by any kind of sensuous configuration. And if art is going to come to the rescue of giving expression to that kind of worldview, that, let's say, thinks of what is a fundamental significance in abstract natural forms or various kinds of abstractions that can't quite be fully captured in sensuous configuration, then it's going to have to use sensuous configuration in a certain way in which it sort of fights against itself to give expression to what can't be fully revealed, but in some respect only partly and ambiguously present. Then you can have the classical art form, where meaning and configuration can go together because the self-understanding is such that it can be presented in sensuous configuration. And then you have the opposite situation of the symbolic form, where the self-understanding of humanity takes a form that could be said to be too concretely self-determining to be restricted to any sensible configuration. And that then puts artistic expression in the challenge of doing what the romantic art form will have to do. Now the question, besides whether these exhaust the possibilities, is whether they have a genetic ordering. And if so, how do we show that that's the case? Is the starting point from which each of them begins something that presupposes a predecessor, in the case of symbolic art? If it is that which comes first and does not depend upon any other art form, then it could be looked upon as being something that is coincident with the emergence of artistic expression, as Hegel suggests. Then if the classical art form is that which is going to come second, and come second because in some way or other it takes as its point of departure the outcome of the working through of the symbolic art form, well, we have to understand how that occurs and to what extent it does occur. And then likewise, with regard to any movement to the romantic art form, well, something in the classical art form would have to be the starting point of the romantic art form. And then there's another side to it. It would appear that we want to think about why there would be a need to move beyond any of these art forms. Why couldn't humanity just have one art form? I mean, even if there are other possibilities, what would lead to these other possibilities? Is there something residing within the enterprise of symbolic art that would, through its own workings by those artists who in some respect are most self-critical and are aware of what they're doing and the difficulties they're encountering, that would lead them or those who are working in the same tradition to end up doing things that are going to drive that art form to its dissolution and thereby set the stage for something different? I mean, is there a sense in which, you know, as an artist, you can no longer you know, do the same paintings that were done 1,000 years ago. And the question is why? And is it possible to see that there's going to be, from within a tradition, a drive to move beyond it that will set the stage for something that follows? And that's why I think it's interesting to look at the discussions of the disillusion of these different forms. Now, as you know, Hegel, in a way, structures each of his accounts of the different art forms as themselves involving a certain kind of process, a process of a kind of self-development. And I say self-development because it's really something that involves modifications that are not caused by things lying outside of the operations of artistic expression. It's something that is going to, in some respect, be internal to the artistic expression that is operating in this way. That it is somehow, in a way, going to be driving itself through different forms of expression. Although, of course, what complicates that in terms of any historical vindication is what that we see over and over again in some of the accounts, maybe not all the accounts, but some of the accounts of these different stages within an art form. What does not happen in terms of the examples he picks that might lead one to think, okay, here we're dealing with stages in a self-development of an artistic tradition. Well, remember, he's not speaking about developments that occur within the same, let's say, historical territory. Now, if you look at the various forms of symbolic art, it's not all occurring in Egypt. It's not all occurring in India. It's not all occurring in Persia, right? It's jumping around from one place to another. And, of course, there are parts of the world where he's not bringing in to speak of. Right? He doesn't have much to say about China in these areas, let alone sub-Saharan Africa, pre-Columbian America, Pacific island areas, and all of these things. You know, these are not part of the material of which he has much information or whatever. On the other hand, when he's talking about classical art and its stages, he does present stages that more or less fall within the same let's say, the same historical corridor. You know, we're talking about developments that occur within the orbit of Greek civilization, and then a slightly wider Mediterranean civilization is going to build itself both parallel to and then on top of and absorb Greek civilization, namely the Roman Empire. So remember, we had these different configurations, these different stages, in a way, of the symbolic art form, starting with the unconscious symbolic art form, becoming somewhat conscious, becoming then art and sublime, and then this comparison, which became a fully conscious symbolic art, and then involved a certain kind of dissolution he spoke of. Well, now we're going to be looking at what happens in his account of the classical art form. And he's going to be doing it, illustrating it. And I say illustration because that's what it should be. It shouldn't be anything more than illustration. Illustrating it by examples drawn from the history of ancient Greek and then Roman civilization, or what we might call classical civilization, as we have come to understand it. So he presents it in terms, really, of kind of three stages. One of which is a process within this tradition, or let's say, within the workings of the classical art form, whereby it constitutes itself out of its, you could say, predecessor art form, or how it's going to constitute itself out of and in reaction to and in incorporating and modifying what you could say the symbolic art form has left at its doorstep. And on that basis, it's then going to come to itself, where it's going to now be in a position to having transformed these antecedent materials and done a certain kind of, shall we say, violence to them, in a certain literal way, in fact, it's now going to be itself, having made itself what it is. And then it's going to, in some respect, dissolve itself. And dissolve itself in a way that's going to be made manifest in the kind of, well, works of art that would be illustrated by things one finds in the Roman Empire, or maybe in Greco-Roman civilization. So that's the itinerary, right? There are three stages here. And then we're going to have the so to speak, transition to the Romantic art form. And there, it's going to appear to be something very different, a very different kind of transition. Because there, it might appear that the transition, even though it may be set up by the dissolution of the classical art form, it's going to be something that Hegel is going to point to as having an external basis. And the external basis is something that takes place in religion. Now, you may remember that when Hegel was speaking about the different situation of the classical artist, the classical artist is someone who has a kind of transparent, clear understanding of what is the fundamental significance to humanity. And in some respect, it's something that exists before them. It exists before them in several ways. What are some of the ways in which it exists before them? So it doesn't have to be created with the kind of wild employment of imagination that symbolic artists had to rely upon. What?
Mythology.
What?
Mythology.
Well, one thing is mythology, right? The claim is that you already have this tradition, existing tradition, which has already presented what? What does mythology present?
Stories of mythology.
Yeah, you could say it presents an understanding of the divine. An understanding of the divine, where the divine is understood to be something that is captured in a way that can be given a sensible configuration that adequately captures it in a way in which humanity can find its true essence at the same time. And what's the other side of that? What's the other side of it? What else is available? Right there. Well, human action, but even more immediately.
Human body.
Exactly, the human body. The human body, the very existence of the human being. Now, first of all, I suggest as you'll see in stylistics, that we don't necessarily want to identify spirit with the human body. Why not?
It's spirit to us more than it is to the human.
And? Why can't the human body be its appropriate embodiment? And it's appropriate existence. Or why can't the appearance of the human body be none other than the appearance of rational agency in a form that is the way in which it appears?
Rational agency can come in many different forms.
Like?
I don't know, aliens?
Yeah, that's all I want to say. You don't want to be fixated upon Homo sapiens, right? We're not necessarily the only form that rational agency can take, either on the planet Earth or anywhere else that can be a biosphere. Right? So that's one thing. You know, it's an illustration. It's one possibility. Or I should say, it's not just one possibility, it's one actuality among potentially infinite others. Okay? But nevertheless, any of them will do the job. Any of them will do the job because they indeed will be the physical presence of rational agency. And if you want to have a configuration that's not going to, in a sense, swamp the fundamental meaning of humanity with something that is unrelated to it, you know, nothing will do the job more immediately, more directly than the human figure. As, of course, infused by what it is that makes the human figure of any kind of fundamental value. Namely, it's informed by knowing and willing. And knowing and willing, it can be autonomous. And thereby be something that, as Hegel will say, can signify itself, as opposed to something else. Right? The human body signifies something else when it has what character? Which it has often in the representations of symbolic art. Well, where it personifies a god, and a god that is not really human, but something of a different character, right? Or it personifies some natural force or whatever. Right? But here you're personifying yourself. You signify yourself. I mean, what are you signifying? You're signifying your own agency. I mean, this is what I'm, this is me, right? Or, you know, ecce homo, basically. Here I am. And there's no need to signify anything else because this is really what matters. So all of this is present. Now, when you talk about the mythology, there's something rather ambiguous about the way in which it's present with regard to, shall we say, the operations of the classical art form. Because what is it that makes the presence of, shall we say, the mythology or the representations of Greek religion and their gods, something whose presence is not external to the classical art form?
Art is written.
Exactly. I mean, the mythology is present in works of art, which is also why Hegel will speak about Greek religion as being, in a sense, a religion of beauty. I mean, that's where you find it. It's presented in various artistic works. It doesn't exist anywhere else. And those works could be said to be those works of the classical art form which are presenting, on the one hand, that one arena of content that's susceptible of artistic configuration, namely the divine, and of course the divine in connection to humanity, and then humanity itself in its activities. Right? So all of that is there. So in a sense, it's not as if we're dealing with an artistic activity that is simply finding what it's presenting. It is producing what it's presenting. And of course, even with regard to its own, the human form, as Hegel points out, if the human form as it's given is going to be proper content, it's the human body, not as a hunk of flesh and meat, like some contemporary artists presented, like Philip Perlstein, I think, or there's someone doing that. Maybe you take the body just as presenting it almost as devoid of any kind of spirit. I can consider why and what that might have to do with any kind of romantic art configuration. But no, the human figure is going to be something that is going to be the appearance of spirit, of something that is of fundamental importance. And that means that exhibits something that could be said to be divine, and that's going to be none other than the thinking and willing that exists nowhere else but in the presence of the human body. Or alternately, of gods that themselves, to the extent that they exhibit the same truth, are going to be anthropocentric. Or anthropomorphic, I should say. Yeah.
So the difference between gods and humans, isn't in thinking and willing.
In what way?
Well, if, I mean, in how it's expressed in art. Like, yeah. If we're trying to figure out the divine yeah. relationship with the human, yeah. and then the human,
yeah.
and like what's important is our capacity or the way we think and or how we express thinking and willing, then is there a distinction between the way they do it, an alien does it, or the gods do it? Or
well,
does
I mean,
thinking look like thinking?
I mean, look, the finite, shall we say, mortals, no matter what their species, you know, are going to think and will in a manner in which is in accord with their finitude. Now, the divinities that are nonetheless giving expression to, shall we say, the infinite value of what it is to be human, are presenting what is to be human in the form of immortals, right? Who escape finitude by being immortal, by having a certain kind of unchanging character. But on the other hand, as Hegel points out, if they're going to be expressed in terms of what can be sensuously configured in a way that, in a sensuous configuration that matches what it is to be, let's say, a spiritual being, a being that knows and thinks and does so in a way that could be said to be divine, they're going to have the human shape and they're going to be individuated from one another. So as Hegel points out, they're going to have to be what? Can they be the one God in a human form? You know, that guy with the big beard. Now, why not? What? Because they have a particularity. And as they have a particularity, they're contrastable with others. That already, in a sense, sets some limit to them. And the limitation, to begin with, are other particular gods. Right? Other particular, shall we say, polytheistic, anthropomorphic deities. And the pantheon will be made up of them. And although they are supposed to have something, shall we say, transcendent, that will be expressive of their infinite character, as well as the infinite character of what it is, what is of essence to humanity, they limit one another. Because they are particular, right? None of them can claim to be all-powerful, right? They have to contend with one another. And even if one might be considered the leader of them all, Zeus, Jupiter, or whatever, still, they are particular, and that way they are subject to contingencies that are not within their power, and that's going to be the basis for what Hegel will later point out will be the role of fate. It cannot be expunged from this kind of framework. And fate will not itself be a particular anthropomorphic entity. Why? Why not? Why not? Because if it were another anthropomorphic entity, it would just be another god in the pantheon. Rather than being expressive of the limitation that they all confront. Because they're not the only God, the all-powerful, the one and only.
So that's why there are three fates?
What?
Why there are three fates?
Well, I don't know if we have to go into there being a multiplicity of fates with regard to, you know, different aspects of the past and the present and the future and different ways in which fate is portrayed. But it's basically this, as Hegel puts it, this, shall we say, indeterminate, inscrutable power to which they're all subject, which is the other side of the expression of the fact that, despite the fact that they have divinity, that they're immortal and the like, the mere fact that they have a sensuously configurable character in the human form means that they are subject to an unpredictable set of contingencies that is operative upon them all, as well as upon us, and that is bound up with their character.
As a plurality of centuries beings in human form.
Yeah, that are nonetheless divine. Because that is how the divine is being construed here. Or, shall we say, what is of ultimate significance? And that also means that we, what is of ultimate significance for us is also something that is the way we appear. Admittedly, an appearance is going to have, from the point of view of art, an idealized form, because everything of the appearance should be conveying the meaning. And that means that we don't want to, what are the kind of things that Hegel says that the portrayal of the human figure, be it as a divinity or a mortal, should not have represented.
Discontent?
What?
Discontent?
Well, not so much. I'm not thinking here about spiritual expressions, but something else that could be regarded as merely natural. Just all these kind of accidental features on the body that do not give expression to the animating spirit, but rather give expression to external accidentalities of one sort or another. So the figure itself is going to be a kind of idealized figure that will try to show the fact that we're dealing with something that is the presence of what is of human significance. Not just a body, but a body that's infused with that and exhibits that immediately. Yes.
Now we're talking about this idea of the combination of meaning and configuration. It seems to me that this kind of combination is only one directional. It's always the imposition of the meaning upon this configuration of matter. Is there, as we also come for the opposite?
I mean, isn't the meaning here something that is, in a way, equivalent to the configuration, where the configuration expresses that meaning, and that meaning is, in some respect, nothing other than the configuration.
But the configuration,
unlike something that operates as a symbol, where there's something they share in common, but there's a difference. I mean, here the meaning is, shall we say, humanity that stands on its own feet, but as adequately present in its given appearance, in its sensuous reality. And that is also how what is of ultimate significance is captured. And so, if you think about it, on the one hand, you find it understood in terms of what is the content of the gods and how are they expressed? What kind of configuration will present that content? Well, the content of the gods is that they are anthropomorphic beings. Now, they're also, as Hegel is going to say, they're going to be, in some respect, incorporating what was provided by the symbolic art form. And this is something he discusses in the very beginning of the process of shaping the classical art form, which is done by classical artists, by classical art itself. It's part of its own development. And he expresses it in the following way. It's something which is going to exhibit a kind of cancellation of the purely natural factors that intrude upon spirit or rational agency. And in some respect, it's going to require a cancellation which is going to involve transforming the natural, so that to the extent that the natural figures, it's going to be a natural that is not alien to rational agency, but is, shall we say, the actual natural configuration of rational agency. So in symbolic art form, right, you had natural powers, immediate natural factors like light, darkness, various powers of various forms, or indeterminate conceptions of the divine, which required a natural expression to be driven against itself in an unnatural way, or involved negative or positive sublimity, etc. Well, here there's going to be a way in which the classical art form is going to form itself by overcoming this way in which natural factors and indeterminate factors have been given fundamental value. So it's going to be a question of the classical art form itself, as part of its artistic expression, overcoming the valuation that these factors had. And that is going to involve successive degradations of these factors. So Hegel plots it out in the following way. And, first, there's going to be a degrading of the animal element and its removal from the sphere of free, pure beauty. Right? Animal configurations were presented as if they had some fundamental significance for humanity. Secondly, more general, less finite, less limited natural powers were also given fundamental significance, personified in gods. They're going to have to be overcome as well. And thirdly, you know, these natural factors are all going to have to be, in some respect, absorbed and relegated to a position that could be said to be at the service of a truer understanding of what is of significance and what is really of essential significance for humanity. So this is something that Hegel lays out as the elements of this way in which the classical art form constitutes itself in artistic production. And first he speaks about the degradation of the animal aspect. Or, you know, you can speak about it as in a way, the way in which forms of nature that are alien to humanity are presented as if they were of fundamental significance for humanity. So how do we do this? First, he speaks about animal sacrifices. Animal sacrifices as involving this and as being something that will be portrayed in artistic works. Now, Hegel contrasts, you know, the practice of animal sacrifice and its portrayal in art as something that really contrasts radically with how animals are treated in symbolic art form. So, for example, if you were to take the ancient Indian civilization and its symbolic art forms, and where divinities, of course, sometimes have animal forms, and where certain animals are regarded as sacred, you do not sacrifice a cow, for example.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just think I have a bunch of animals.
And today, you know, there are people still being killed by mobs who are being accused of having slaughtered cows and the like.
Sorry.
Yeah. So, and the Egyptians, what do the Egyptians do to animals? Were they partly portrayed as being part of or whole of what is divine? What did they do to them in contrast to sacrifice? Well, they preserved them. They mummified them instead of allowing them to putrefy. But what does the classical art form do when it's talking about animal sacrifice? It not only kills the animal, what else does it do? It eats the animal. It may give some of the unedible parts to the gods, but it is willing to eat the rest of the oxen or whatever else. So look, this is a way in which, as part of artistic expression and representations, the significance of the animal is degraded. Although, as Hegel points out, there's a certain element of a certain respect shown animals, in that certain animals, as opposed to other animals, are regarded as being fit for sacrifice. So that involves a little element of the veneration of certain animals. You know, you're not going to sacrifice a cockroach to the god, but something else. But nonetheless, here you have animal sacrifice. Then also hunts. You have hunting and the killing of animals portrayed in the classical art form in terms of its content. You have Hercules killing the Nemean lion. Various kinds of natural monsters are being killed, etc. Again, this is, Hegel claims, a way of giving expression to this degradation of the animal, and an assertion of the human as being the proper locus of what counts for humanity. And then likewise you have it in the Metamorphoses. You know, we came across Metamorphoses that, in terms of the dissolution of the symbolic art form, and in fact that also did include reference to Ovid, who here of course figures it. I mean, Ovid of course is someone within the spectrum, at least of Greek civilization. Well, what is it that Metamorphoses do that is, for example, so different from the transmigration of souls that you find in the Egyptians, the ancient Indians, where the human may be reborn in an animal form? And
punishment?
Yeah, here it's meant as a punishment and degradation of the human. And that's the whole point of all these stories of Metamorphoses of Ovid. Where someone is reborn as a donkey, or whatever it may be, because of, you know, the degraded life they've been living as a form of punishment. Likewise, you know, in the Odyssey, when Circe bewitches men, again, it's a degradation of them. When Zeus takes on the forms of animals, like swans or whatever, how is this not an elevation or veneration of the animal? How do you know? Yeah.
Doesn't he usually do it to commit some act that he ought not to be doing?
Yeah, exactly. Here he's acting himself in a bestial way, let's say, as opposed to presenting what would be worthy of... and here he's, shall we say, all too human, or maybe all too bestial to human. And then what about all the hybrid forms? What does Hegel have in mind in terms of the hybrid forms that we find, at least in the exemplification of the classical art form in ancient Greece, and what they signify? I mean, what are these hybrid forms that are part animal, part human?
Is it the, like, Minotaur and the satyrs?
Yeah. Centaurs, Minotaur, all of these. And what is significant about the way in which they are portrayed that indicates here we're dealing with not an elevation of the animal, like you might in terms of Ganesha, the god that is like an elephant, or Hanuman, the god that's like a monkey king. Well, again, they have the kind of bestial side to them. They're, you know, they're known for their, let's say, animalistic behavior, not as being something that provides us with a model of what matters for us as humans. Okay, so that's one side of it. That's one side in which the classical art form is overcoming the limitations in a very express way of the art form that it finds before it. And it does find it before it, at least some of it. After all, ancient Egypt is there. You also have the cultures that pre-existed, the archaic cultures that existed, classical civilization. Well, then you have something else, the battle between the old gods and the new. Well, what are the old gods? The old gods are defined in terms of Greek mythology as being these kind of nature gods, right? Expressing natural powers or whatever. Now, they are humans of sort, but they are more personifications of these natural forces. They don't have the full-fledged character that will be ascribed to the new gods. And the new gods are going to be portrayed as defeating the old gods. They will kill the old gods. They'll destroy the old gods. And that transformation is represented. And what is it that now characterizes the new gods? It's the fact that they're very subjectivity. You know, they each have a kind of character that can be regarded as a distinctive kind of human character. Not something that is to be found in terms of some natural power. On the other hand, Hegel points out and seems to suggest that this is something that is going to be significant. They incorporate within them a side of nature, which we'll get to in a moment. That's something that puts forward as sort of the third aspect of this movement. But first we have the way in which divinity is now being construed and portrayed in a way where it is debasing the independent power of nature and also any kind of indeterminate forces or indeterminate absolute that could lord over spirit, lord over the subjectivity of individuals. Well, he also speaks about oracles. What is the role of oracles here? As a way of, in a certain sense, you could say, debasing nature or subsuming nature. I mean, what do the oracles do? And notice, not as if the voice of the divine is a divine that personifies a natural power. Rather, these natural phenomena are going to be interpreted as expressing the knowing and willing of gods who are regarded as having a character, a subjectivity of their own, rather than being a power of nature. So in these ways, we have a kind of debasement and overpowering of nature and, in a sense, the triumph of, call it, rational agency as being what infuses the divine. And a rational agency that is, nevertheless, something that is sensibly configurable because it is in the form of a natural embodiment that is the embodiment of knowing and willing, namely the human form. Now Hegel lastly brings in something that could be said to be the positive side of this, right? Here we have the kind of, in a way, the degrading, the negating, the overcoming, you know, the belittling of these forces and natural givens that were elevated to supreme significance, and whose supreme significance had to be expressed in symbolic art. Now you have that negative work, but now there's a positive side to it. What Hegel calls the affirmative retention of the negated features. And he speaks about it in several things. He speaks, first of all, about the mysteries, right? You had these mysteries that operated in Greek civilization. He doesn't say too much to explain them, but there were these practices that involved things that were only known to certain practitioners. They involved a return to certain kinds of old traditions, but again, this is all operating in a very subordinate way. On the other hand, you preserve some of the old gods and artistic representations, right? You do have myths regarding the old gods, their defeat. But then also the new gods are going to be something where they have a natural basis to them. What is he talking about? And how does it operate? And sometimes it operates in two ways. One way is that you have natural powers that are connected to a god, and then you also have certain animals that are connected. So how are they incorporated in a way that gives a kind of positive affirmation of this new ideal? Well, the gods happen to be, and Hegel seems to suggest this is not arbitrary, they happen to be tied to different natural powers, Poseidon, the sea, Zeus, thunder, lightning, etc. Various other gods associated with other aspects of the earth. And then in their artistic portrayals, they'll be accompanied by a certain animal as a kind of accessory, but only as an accessory. And then, even though they're connected to a certain power, they're not a personification of that power. They have that power, but in addition to that, they have a fully concrete individuality with all sorts of other concerns, which gets them involved in all sorts of various kinds of conflicts. And all of that is present. Now, by the way, if we say that the composition of these kind of gods is going to involve an incorporation of nature, but in a subservient way, so that it fits a divinity that can emphasize the independence of the spiritual, of rational agency, but at the same time that it is adequately embodied in a sensuous configuration, namely the human body. How does that give support to the idea that the classical art form follows from the symbolic art form? Well, in other words, if the classical art form incorporates within its content and its corresponding configurations features that come from symbolic art and its self-understanding, and come from it in a way in which they have been transformed in a certain manner, as part of how what the classical art form presents as being significant shows its significance, then you might say there's an internal tie between the two. Could, on the other hand, the classical art form do its thing without necessarily presenting as part of its own artistic creations these kind of transformations? Can it just come to us, you know, in its full form from the very beginning? Do we have to think of these, the classical art form, like the symbolic art form, as something that works itself out, and in working itself out, presents a kind of region with different stages, maybe even possibilities.
For this work, the symbolic art form has to be ingredient in at least the apprehension of the classical art form.
Yeah, I mean, if it is, then you see a positive connection. And then you might say, okay, the symbolic art form is in some respect antecedent to the classical art form. And that would be a way of trying to give some strong support to that notion.
But this would also allow us, I mean, it would preclude the possibility of finding classical art just everywhere, the way you can find symbolic art just...
Well, when you say everywhere, what do you mean?
There's
by that?
No antecedent, there isn't the antecedent condition with symbolic art, only humanity fighting against nature. So yeah. Everywhere humanity fought against nature, there's a potential for symbolic art.
Yeah.
But if classical art is like needs this, you know, antecedent condition, then it's only places that produces it.
And remember, Hegel actually poses things exactly as you have, where he says, you know, what is the presupposition of the classical art form? It's not that you have nature, or nature operating vis-a-vis humanity. It's rather that you have a nature that has been artistically produced as something to which we, humanity, have given fundamental significance. That's what the classical art form is rising up against and has to contend with in order to affirm its own importance. And to do so, you might even say polemically, it has to undermine that and show that this is what makes us true. And by the same token, you might ask the same questions when we come to the transition from the classical art form to the romantic art form. Is there something akin to that in a way?
But does it undermine it in a way that abolishes it? Or is it still ingredient in the classical art?
Well, he points to how it's ingredient, but how it's been, these factors have been absorbed, but belittled, diminished, made accessories, as opposed to things that are, shall we say, where divinity essentially resides, or where humanity is going to find its orientation. So something else is happening. Well, why don't we take a break now and reconvene in about, let's say, 10 minutes, and we will then get into the ideal of classical art and look at the dissolution briefly.